Good morning. It's good to be with everyone this morning. If you will, turn your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 29. We'll dive into the Old Testament for a couple of passages. Jeremiah chapter 29. I was looking back through my records, and if memory serves me right, I think today marks 3 years since Aaron's called me and said, hey, would you like mind filling in part-time? And part-time turned into full-time, and then full-time turned into 7 months, and 7 months turned into 3 years, and I really couldn't be more pleased. I never expected this. I had prayed for other opportunities to open up. Those never opened up, and this opened up, and I think I am all the better for it. Things have changed over the last 3 years. For those who were here 3 years ago, I think just looking around the building, we see that things changed. And that really has nothing to do with me. God is always the one who gives the increase. And you take one person out of one location, you put them in a different location that has a different zeal, a different love, a different passion, and the work's going to be completely different, even if you move person to the different location. The greatest asset that we have is you guys. All the love, all the zeal, all the passion, all the growth has been done because of the watering and the planting that has been done by you all. And I am pleased to be just a small part of the great work that's going on here. I want to talk about a topic this morning that is slightly different than we kind of usually talk about. In Jeremiah chapter 29, in verses 11 through 14, there's not a whole lot of passages that we kind of have used from Jeremiah. We're going to look at two of the most popular ones. We want to ask the question today, does God have a plan for you individually? The question comes up, does God pick out a purpose or a plan in your life that he works with you individually? Jeremiah chapter 29, starting in verse 11, is a passage that is often quoted for this. For God says, I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord. I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and all the places where I have driven you, declares the Lord. I will bring you back from the place from which I sent you into exile. Usually, just verses 11 and verse 12 are the ones that are quoted from Jeremiah chapter 29. This is the passage you might see thrown up on those, you know, pretty pictures with the words on them. Sometimes they scroll through your Facebook newsfeed that God has a plan for you individually, that this passage promises you that God has known you and plans things for you. And then on the other hand, you see a whole volley of other people who say, well, this passage isn't promising individual plans. If you look at the context, Jeremiah chapter 29 is a letter that's written by God to the exiles, that God has driven the people of Israel into captivity, and he says, I have a plan for you. For the sake of my Messiah who will be coming, I have plans to prosper you and to bring you out of exile into the land. And then if we kind of push Jeremiah chapter 29 aside, we say, well, let's go over Jeremiah chapter 1. Jeremiah chapter 1 doesn't deal with a nation, it deals with an individual. So over in Jeremiah chapter 1 is where Jeremiah gets his commissioning, if you will. And this is probably the second most quoted passage from Jeremiah, at least when it comes to pretty pictures with words on them. There in verse 5, as God commissions Jeremiah, he says to him, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you, and I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. Again, usually we grab just the first part of that statement, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you. And so while chapter 29 deals with a nation, chapter 1 deals with an individual. And God points out to Jeremiah, before you even were born, I knew you, and I had a plan for you, and I had purposed all this for you. And as you go through Jeremiah, you realize that Jeremiah isn't always completely on board with all of God's plan. He does kind of speak up from time to time to say that I'm not really pleased with all that you planned and purposed for me. But chapter 1 seems to indicate that God had a specific plan for Jeremiah. And sometimes this verse is used to say, well, this is going to be for you, that God has an individual plan for you. Now, on the other hand, you have the whole other volley of people that says, well, this is Jeremiah. God's purpose for Jeremiah, this isn't a universal plan for everybody that God has picked out universally for you. So that leaves us in this quandary. If these are the two most popular verses to talk about God having individual plan in your life and a purpose for you individually, and neither one of these talk about you individually, but talk about Jeremiah individually and the nation of Israel collectively, where does that leave us? Does God have a plan for you individually or not? Is there a purpose in your life or not? Is the purpose kind of fulfilled only in salvation, or is there more that God has planned for you? So I'm going to torture you a little extra today. We have quite a bit of stuff to get through. I hope that 3 years is a really good time to end that honeymoon phase. It's a good time to torture you guys just a little bit more. So we're going to do that. And I want to try to look at passages that deal with some of the very basics of Christianity and hopefully point us to an answer of whether or not God has a purpose or a plan for you in your life and the way that you live. So I want to look at some of the things that we often talk about, but maybe not in the exact context of this question. I want to talk about the purpose of design. Have you ever wondered why God made you the way that you are? In a world that is so focused on physicality, on the way that you look and the way that you present yourself, why did he make me the way that I am? You ever wonder about that when it comes maybe even your health? Why is it that some people have good eyesight and some people have bad eyesight? Why is it some people get to hear well and then other people are just me? Why is it that other people have great family genetics and other people just happen to look like I look, unfortunately? Why? And the answer is that God has chosen you and made you in a way that is going to best serve his purposes. That if everyone looked the same, if everyone acted the same, if everyone was genetically identical, then that would mean one thing. But if God has designed and purposed and planned you individually, then there must be some things that are going to be unique to you and roles and responsibilities, things that are going to be put into your life that are going to be unique to your situation. I would suggest that design implies a purpose. If you were going to go out and you're going to go in your workshop, or if you're going to sit down at your sewing table, or if you were going to sit down and make something at the forge, whatever it is that you choose to make and you choose to do, whenever you make something, very rarely do you ever make something that has no purpose. If you design it, you sit down, you draw a blueprint, you write, sketch out a plan, a design implies a purpose. I think we see that innately in our lives. When we see the design, we intuit that God has designed me, therefore there is a purpose in my life. And yet, sometimes we feel that we are lost without living and finding the purpose that God has in our life for us. How many people in this world spend their time looking for, what is my purpose? I'm only here for X amount of years. I'm here for 35 years. I'm here for 75 years. I'm here for 95 years. Whatever my time period is, it feels a lot shorter every year. And we live our lives thinking, I only have this one life to live. What is it that I have to do? And we see that God has designed me, that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, that he has created me unique with my thoughts, my actions, my feelings. What is it that God has purpose for me? And whenever we don't find that, because it is innately in us to have a purpose, we often feel lost and adrift without a rudder to direct us. I want us to consider a couple passages. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. The questions often arise inside of a congregation over what role do I serve? What purpose do I have? And in chapter 12, he deals directly with spiritual gifts, he deals with the broader application in verses 18 and following. That not every one of us has the same role or the same function inside of the church. That each one of us has our own unique skills or gifts or abilities that we are to use in the way that we can to best serve one another and to the praise and the glory and honor of God. But I want us to note here in verse 18. Now, so you have this conflict of not everybody does the same job. And if I don't do the same job that Aaron does, well, then I can look down on Aaron and say, well, I get to do this job and Aaron only gets to do that job. Or vice versa. Aaron could look at me and say, well, because you don't have my skills and my abilities, you aren't nearly as useful or as profitable or as loved by God. And he sets it very clear here in chapter 12 that when it comes to your body, the body of Christ, that there is no one part or one function that is inherently better than any other. But then he tells us in verse 18 something very specific. As it is, God has arranged the members in the body, each one of them, as he chose. He makes the point very clear that God has arranged or has purposed things for you. That inside the body, he has made it so that you have a role and you have a responsibility inside the local body. The same thing goes in verse 24, a couple of verses later. He makes the point that, but God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the parts that lack it, that there be no division in the body, but the members have the same care one for another. Two times here in chapter 12, he makes the point that God has arranged or God has designed the body the way that he has. And design implies a purpose. He makes the point here back in verse 19, if all were a single member, as it is, or if all were a single member, there would be no body. But as it is here in verse 20, there are many parts and yet one body. We understand this analogy very well in our lives. If all your parts were a hand, your body wouldn't be very functional. If everything was only an eye, you would want for a lot more variety. And so it is in the church, that we all are given our own gifts, our own abilities, that we all have our own purpose, and God has designed that for us. Isaiah chapter 29, verse 16, we don't have to go back there if you don't want to. Just very quickly in verse 16, he gives the analogy of God as a potter who sits at his wheel and he forms us out of clay. And he asks the question in verse 16, can you who was made say back to the maker, why have you made me such? The point is that we are designed or we are created in God for a purpose. And if we do not serve in that purpose or we don't want to serve in the purpose that we have been made for, or do we have the right to answer back to God? Why have you made me this way? Which is kind of where we started this whole discussion. Why has God made me the way that I am? Why do I have to look the way that I look, unfortunately? Why is it that I have all the genetic faults that I happen to have? That may be West Virginia, but that's a whole other topic. But the question is, if God has designed me, then there must be a purpose to go along with that. And there is a need, I believe, for us to see God's design. If we fail to see God's design in us, then we also will fail to see God's design in our lives. We fail to see God's design in our lives, then despair and despondency and apathy will begin to rule. And we see that all over the world. We see that in people who fail to see that God has a purpose for them. And if I have no purpose in life, all the pleasures will be unpleasurable. All the things that will give me joy will eventually run out of joy. If all that I have is just this life, and this life is so fleeting and so full of misery and hardship, and there is no purpose and no design in that, then despair and despondency and apathy will most certainly rule. We need to begin to see that God has designed you and that design implies a purpose. I want to talk about another aspect of Christianity. I know that a couple of us have talked about this individually, that it seems to be, when it comes to the topic of providence, that Christians sometimes sway to one end or the other. Either it's I was driving in the parking lot and I had a lot of groceries I needed to get and my bladder was extra full and all of a sudden a parking spot opened really close to the door and God provided that for me. Or to the other end of saying, well, that's a bit foolish to think that God is being so petty as to open up parking spaces for one person, not the other person. Therefore, providence is only provided through the scriptures. And for whatever reason, we seem to sway from one end to the other. We either think that everything and anything small is immediately and inherently a prosperity of God, or that God prospers, but maybe in a very, very oblique way. We tend to separate ourselves and to go to extremes in that matter. But I want us to really consider James chapter 1. We're going to be flipping passages quite a bit today, and I both apologize and both encourage you to take the time to look at these passages in context. James chapter 1, James writes to those who are being spread abroad. If my timeline is accurate, then this will be written sometime around Acts chapter 8, Acts chapter 9, whenever the church was primarily Jewish and was spread abroad, spreading the gospel. So he begins with the trials and the testing that they're going to go through in verse 2. And then he tells them in verse 16 to not be deceived. That as they go abroad and as they move from where they are in Jerusalem to whatever town they're going to be moving to, or from town to town, starting new jobs, having new homes, whatever is going to go on in their life. He says, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. That every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. God provides everything good. And then without him, nothing good comes into our lives. And things that we would force in there that are against God's will are not really all that good. Or a couple pages back into 1 Timothy chapter 6, we had kind of finished this a couple weeks ago in our Tuesday night Bible class. He deals with the idea of physical prosperity, or those who are rich in chapter 6. And towards the very end, in verse 17, he gives this command. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything. If we do not believe that God doesn't personally act in our lives, then what is the topic of providence all about? Or as you get over into Matthew chapter 7, verses 8 through 11, where he says, ask and you shall receive, knock and it will be opened to you. If we don't believe in prayer as a direct means to petition God for the needs in our lives, and that God does not directly answer us for those things individually, then what is providence all about? Why would God provide things and supply things if there was no purpose, if there was no plan? Why would God give those things over to us? Or in Romans chapter 8, verses 31 and 32, when he says, what shall we say to these things? If God gave his son up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? God provides real purpose and real meaning, along with all good things in life. One of the biggest lies that we tell ourselves is that we can provide in our lives without God and make the things the way that we want them to without God. What I mean by that is that we want pleasure in life, and so we go out and we try to make things pleasurable. But they only last for a season, and eventually what we get is disappointment. We want purpose, and so we try to make a purpose for ourselves, and yet what we always find is just emptiness if our purpose is not established by God. We try to find meaning in life, and yet when we look and we search without God, all we find is hopelessness. We try to live a life of just happiness. We see despair and despondency. We see worries and cares on people, and so we try to fluff all of those things off and just live just pure happiness in our lives, only to get more pain in return. We try to find hope, because hope is one of those things that we innately want. We want love, we want peace, we want joy, we want hope, and so we try to make things hopeful for the future, only to see self-destruction in the end. Whatever we sow apart from God, we never get to reap the same thing. It is only God who provides those good things in our lives. And with God, with his plan and with his purpose for us, then he richly provides us those good things. Whenever we want pleasure and purpose and meaning and happiness and hope, those are things that God will richly provide for us. But without God, our plans and our lives are nothing. There's an old story of the house with golden windows. There was a boy who would wake up every morning and he would look out through his bedroom window, and across the moor and across the field there was a house. And every morning he got to see those beautiful golden windows. And he dreamt for months about what it would be like to live in a house, not this ramshackle house that he lived in, but a house with golden windows. And so one day he asked his dad if he could, take him to the house with the golden windows. And so his dad said, sure, we're happy to do that. And so they walked around the moor, and they came to the other side of the moor and they crossed the field. And they were standing outside of the only house that was there and looking quizzically. And so the little girl comes out and says, what are you looking for? Can I help you? And the little boy replies to the little girl, says, yes, I'm looking for the house with the golden windows. And she quickly replies, "Oh, I'm sorry you come to the wrong place, but if you wait until sunset, then I will be able to tell you where the house of the golden windows is just across the moor." Sometimes we look into worlds around us or people's lives around us, and we think that they must surely live in houses with golden windows, realizing that their life without God is as absolutely empty as our life is without God. The lifestyles of the rich and the famous are only half-truths. There's only so much that money can buy. And purpose and meaning and hope, those are things that are completely unobtainable by wealth or by fame. And you find people all the time who live their life rich and famous or popular or powerful, wanting more out of life because they seek to make their purpose in their life their own, only to find that their own purpose is empty. It is God who richly provides us with all good things. Look at Jeremiah chapter 10 with me. Jeremiah chapter 10. A third area that we talk about quite a bit in our life as Christians is guidance or direction from God. And maybe this is a part of our daily prayers, that God would guide us or God would direct us in the areas of life that we would like to succeed in. And in Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23, Jeremiah makes this profound statement. He says, "I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his steps." And so what he asks is, "Correct me, O Lord, in your justice, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing." It's not in man who walks to direct his steps. It's not in us to guide ourselves to where we want to go. In Psalm 31 and verse 3, I know we're skipping around quite a bit, but all of these passages are one that I think are extremely important to take into context. Psalm 31, there in verse 3, this is a psalm of David, and he asks him in verse 3, "For you are my rock and my fortress, and for your name's sake you lead me and guide me." What does it mean for us to ask God to lead us? We had looked a couple weeks ago in the model prayer in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 13, where Jesus teaches us to pray, "Lead us not into temptation, but to deliver us from evil." What is the purpose of asking God to direct us if we don't think that there's a path that God should be leading us down? If I'm just going to make my own way in life, if I'm just going to make my own course, my own path, and that God has no plan or no purpose for me, then what would his guidance serve in my life? If we do not ask, seek, and follow God's direction, we are missing a huge part of our Christian walk. If there is a plan and a purpose for us by God, then failing to ask and failing to seek and then diligently following that plan of guidance will result in a less than productive life. It is filled through the entire Psalms. I just picked out one. We could have picked out probably 40 or 50 Psalms where the psalmist asks for God to guard or direct or to guide or to direct his steps or to establish. In fact, that's the next part we want to talk about. What does it mean for God to establish us? In Proverbs chapter 16, I've been spending quite a bit of my personal time inside of the poetry and wisdom literature. And so if this comes up a lot, you'll know why. But Proverbs chapter 16, Solomon makes this statement, and kind of out of context, it's hard to fully understand, and so I hope that we are able to put it back in context in this topic and understand it very well. There in Proverbs 16 and verse 9, he says, "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps." Now, there are things that you plan in your life. I think all of us, to some degree, have a plan for what we would like to do this week. In fact, Brittany and I were talking that over. We kind of hold two schedules that we then kind of blend together so that, you know, all my work can get done and all of her work with the kids get done and we get to do family activities. So Sunday morning, we're driving this morning, and she said, "What are your plans for this week?" And she discusses her plans for this week, and we make sure that our schedules align so we get all that we need to get done. That's what he's talking about. We plan. We make steps, not only for this week, but hopefully what we'd like to do for the rest of 2020. until it finally ends, and then move on into 2021. Whenever all of the travel restrictions and all the all the stuff in life begins to open up again, we make all these plans. What we would like to do for this year or for next year, but what we plan and what actually comes about very rarely are the same things. I mentioned before, 3 years ago, I had in my mind what I was going to do, which was not involving you guys. Not because I didn't like you guys, I just didn't know you guys existed. And not in a bad way, I just lived an hour away. And we make plans, but it's God who establishes our steps. A couple of chapters over in Proverbs chapter 20 and in verse 24. There in verse 24, he says, "A man's steps are from the Lord, and how can a man understand his way?" What I mean by this, what Solomon means by this, I believe, is that God prospers us whenever we diligently seek his will. You know, that's the point that the psalmist makes in Psalm 37, verse 23, that the steps of a man are established by the Lord when he delights in his way. You know, there are things that we plan, and there are things that we act upon. And there are some things that God is going to prosper, and there are some doors that God is going to close. It's still up for us to move and for us to act, but is God who then prospers, God who then establishes. But if God has no plan or no purpose in your life, then what would it mean for him to establish your steps or to establish your way if there was no plan or no prospects? Or let's look at Romans chapter 8. This is probably one of the most poignant passages on this topic. Romans chapter 8, verses 27 through verse 29. Paul makes a point there in verse 27, "And he who searches the heart knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to his will. And we know that those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who were called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to his image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those who he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those who he justified, he also glorified." I think verse 28 is one of our favorite passages from Romans chapter 8. That all things work together for good. This is one that we always bring out. This is our back pocket verse whenever things go bad. You know, I know that things are hard right now, but all things work together. But if God had no plan, if he did not work directly in our lives, what would it mean that God could weave all things together for good? What would it mean for you to go through suffering if God didn't have a purpose in that suffering? These are some of the really important parts of our Christian walk, is to see God's plan, God's design in this. We do not receive direct personal revelations from God. I mean, Hebrews chapter 1 makes that very clear, that in times past, God spoke through the prophets by dreams and signs. But he's now, today, speaks through his Son, which would be through the Bible. And we are to act according to his revealed word, and then watch as God establishes our actions, grows our work, because it's him who wills and works in us for his good pleasure. Or how about this other topic we often talk about, God's protection. In Matthew chapter 6 and verse 13, that model prayer, the verse we already talked about, where he tells us to pray that God would lead us not into temptation, but to deliver us from evil. That we're to call on God as a mighty fortress, as a tower and a refuge, a place of safety in a time of need. Or in 1 John chapter 5, if you go over right towards the very end of 1 John, right down into the very last section, chapter 5 and verse 18, where he says that we know that everyone who has been born of God does not keep on sinning, but he who is born of God protects him, and the evil one does not touch him. If we failed to see that God has a purpose and understand that we need to rely on his protection, which is vital to us carrying out that purpose, then we're going to live our life thinking that we had a whole bunch of close calls and that we've gotten really lucky. or that karma exists and that you reap exactly what is owed you. So whenever good things happen, it's because you've been a really good person, therefore you deserve good things. Or vice versa, when you look at other people and you see bad things happen to them, well, they deserve that, obviously. Do bad things happen to you, you deserve that. And we failed to see God's protection in our lives. That God does not always deal with us according to our sins, that he knows our frame and that we are but mere flesh. Man, that is such an important aspect of our life, to realize that, not everything bad that happens to you is because a direct consequence of what you've done, but maybe there's a purpose or a plan in that. And that whenever good things happen to other people, it's not because automatically they've been inherently wonderful and deserve those things, but that God might have a purpose and a plan and their blessings as well, or vice versa. Understanding and seeing that God provides for us is an important thing in our lives, or even using you in his service. I want to look at two quick passages. We're getting really close to the end, I promise. It's 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. We looked at this passage on our Tuesday night class very, very recently. And by very recently, I mean this coming Tuesday night. Not to speak of the future too, certainly. Lord willing, we will talk about this on Tuesday night. There in verse 20. He says, "Now in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honorable use and some for dishonorable. Therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, he will be a vessel for honorable use, set apart as holy and useful to the master of the house, ready for every good work." There's a lot of dependencies on that, but he makes the point here that, we get to be vessels and that we get to be useful to God. And if God didn't have a plan or a purpose, if he didn't work directly in our lives to some degree, then what would be the purpose of this analogy? That there is a vessel that is ready to be used for God's house. And then he makes this contingency clause there in verse 21. If anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, then he will be set apart as holy and useful to the master for every good work. God works through us. I mean, isn't that the exact point that Paul makes in Philippians chapter 2? It is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Or in Ephesians chapter 2 and in verse 10. Here in Ephesians chapter 2 and in verse 10, he makes the point that before we were Christians, that we were slaves of Satan, that we gave our lives over to pleasures and passions, that we lived our days in envy and malice and jealousy. But when the goodness and the greatness of God appeared, he saved us. But I want us to look there in Ephesians chapter 2 and in verse 10. He makes the point that we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. That God has purposed and made us the way that we are, that he has fashioned us and molded us, that he has sculpted us like a potter, that he has carved us like a carver. Analogies are breaking down real fast. That he has smelted us and that he has worked us over like a precious metal for his work, for his purpose. That we can be used for God for his good pleasure. We can do great and wonderful things if we cleanse ourselves to be ready and useful to him. Each of us has been made differently for one another, to fulfill his work in a very special way. I want us to give a really good example, biblically speaking, from the book of Esther. There's two books from the Old Testament that were highly debated back in the day, whether or not they should be included in the canon. One is the Song of Solomon. Other one is Esther, both for the same reason, that God is not mentioned in either one of those books. The name of God never appears. But Esther is such a beautiful example of what our lives look like from the perspective of someone who does not get direct revelations from God. Esther lived her life with no mention of God, with no direct revelation, and yet through the entire book, you can see how God weaves the entire story together from the very beginning to the very end, where he manipulates situations and circumstances, that he both makes this beautiful tapestry through his design through love and his protection of this Jewish people, by providence of having the right things at the right time, being read by the right people, or things said in the earshot of the right people, that people forget things at the right time and then remember them at some other convenient time, that he establishes and guides along the way, all without ever seeing him. And that's what we're talking about today. We can see in Esther and her uncle Mordecai that God had a plan and that he weaved that design through them. That whenever they fully submitted themselves to God and to his will, if I die, I die. Great and wonderful things happened through that. And while we didn't see God through that, we don't hear of him speaking directly, we can see clearly his design as we step back and we read the whole book. So the question that comes up, does God have a plan for us? Does he work in our lives? The answer is yes. I want to leave you with a really, really good analogy. In northern India, there's a village that is known for weaving wedding saris. Not the apologies like you get in Canada, just the regular Indian saris. They're long, they're 6 meters long, and they are gorgeous. Some of the most vibrant reds, blues, greens. They have gold and silver that aren't just looking like gold and silver. They weave real gold and silver threads through them. And there's this beautiful process. There is usually a father-son team working on a single loom together. Behind the loom stands the father with all of his spools of thread around him. And he begins to pull threads in and out and to hold them together. And the son sits in the lotus position in front of the loom. And his job is to move the shuttle back and forth. And so as the father grabs the strands and he moves them back and forth, they work almost completely in silence. The father nods and the son moves the shuttle. And the father then manipulates more of the threads, and the father nods, and the son moves the shuttle. From the son's perspective, it's really uncomfortable. I can't imagine sitting for hours every day in the lotus position just waiting to move the shuttle. It's also probably pretty boring. Just a wild guess. Sitting there not knowing what's going to happen. And the son doesn't know the design while the father is weaving. The father is back there pulling all the threads, making it all happen, and he simply nods, and the son simply moves the shuttle. The whole time, the father keeps this elaborate design in his mind. And they work not for a single day or for a single week. They work for weeks and sometimes months to make these wedding saris. And they're absolutely beautiful. But you have this father-son team who works in tandem, mostly in silence, where the father pulls all the threads and the father nods. And the son moves at his nod. And the whole sari is not seen, the pattern is not seen in a single move of the shuttle. It's not seen in a single day's work. It is seen at the revelation of the entire piece of work, the entire 6 meters. And its real beauty is seen whenever that sari gets put onto the bride. And she goes to her wedding. And I think that makes such a beautiful analogy for us as God's people. That God weaves in our lives. That he stands behind the loom and he pulls all the threads together. And as he directs and nods, we move. And we don't know what the design is going to be like at the end. Whenever you examine a painting, you don't look at just one or two brushstrokes to understand what's happening. Whenever you see a beautiful piece of work as a sari, you don't see that in just a couple threads. You don't see the design in God's life and God has in your life in just a few moves of the shuttle. You get to see that at the end sometimes. But you don't have to know what God's design is fully in order to move at his nod.